The DHI Podcast with Dom Chambers. Developing health and independence.
On the podcast today, we're going to explore the culture of DHI and really understand what developing health and independence means. We'll discover that the origin of DHI was about the need for supported housing for people with drug and alcohol issues. And as our story unfolds, we'll see why that relationship between housing and recovery from addictions is still important to this day. We'll do this by hearing evidence through lived experience and people's stories and many people involved in the mission of DHI. And as all this unfolds, I think we'll gain the impression that ultimately recovery is about overcoming your limitations and indeed that which limits you and fulfilling your potential. Adrian is an ex-client of DHI.
I was using crack cocaine for a really long time, almost 10, 15 years, and I got into a really dark place, basically homeless, and as I was getting a lot older, I realised I really need to do something to change my life. I'd become a shadow of myself. I kind of hid from friends, hid from families, because I was just ashamed of who I'd become. And eventually I went to treatment where my counsellor suggested that I'd come to DHI. I'd never been to Bath before, so I didn't know anything about Bath, the city, and its heritage. All I knew about was DHI and how amazing this place was. And so I kind of agreed to come here, did an assessment and got into DHI, and that's where I was able to readjust into society by having somewhere to live, having a key worker who I could trust. And I engaged in the groups at DHI, and eventually I went to university and got work and then started my own business.
Meeting Adrian was a real pleasure, and hearing his story of how he'd turned his life around. But key to that story, as he tells us, are the support systems and that wider community that you can be part of at DHI, so that you are increasingly in control of your life direction. That culture of a supporting community has been infused at the heart of DHI from the very start, as the charity's chief executive, Rosie Phillips, tells me.
I really got to understand how important it was that people are given a safe place to live, but also that sense of community, the support people get from mutual aid, if you want to call it that, or support from people going through something similar, and what a strong recovery that can build for people.
Rosie's speaking to me there rather appropriately, and it explains the background celebratory sounds in that piece. We were talking at an event to mark the 20th anniversary of DHI's first safe house in Stall Street. And many of these stories of recovery that are in these podcasts come from conversations I had that evening. But this idea that the journey of recovery has a far greater chance of going to a positive place when people have a roof over their head, they're in safe housing, which comes with that supporting community that Rosie was touching on there. Well, all that are crucial milestones in Una's story.
I was living on the streets in Oxford. My children were with various family members, and my husband was in prison. And I was signing on at two different police stations and two different names. And I was going to go to prison. And my family had been asking me for years and years to allow them to be able to help me. But all I wanted was their money so I could buy drugs. I was completely obsessed by it, and I didn't think I was ever going to be able to stop. And I was in court, standing in the dark. I looked out towards the door in the court. There was two women looking in, and I didn't recognize who they were. And the next time I turned around, they were sitting at the front, and they were my sisters, two of my sisters. And I hadn't seen them for years. I didn't even recognize them when they were standing at the door. And they were crying. And I thought, why are they crying? I'm the one with the problem. And I came out of there and I said to my sisters, can you give me some money? I've been in a cell for 3 days and I'm really ill. And they did. And I went and I got some heroin and I came back to the car. I sat in the car and I started crying and I just said to my sister, I can't do this anymore. I was 43. And she started crying. She said, Una, you don't know how long we've been waiting for you to say that. And within 3 days, all my family had got together and found me a place at a treatment center. And I was in there within 3 days. I spent 6 months in there. And that was when I came to Bath. Find somewhere new, somewhere safe, somewhere I hadn't been using drugs. I didn't know anybody here. And that was good for me. You know, I learned in the treatment center that I needed to go to meetings and get to know people. And there was a dry house. And if I could get somewhere there, then I would have some structure and some discipline. And, you know, the minute I went to meetings, I met loads of people and got lots of names. And used to go to the groups at DHI. So I got to know people there. And I got to know Rosie. Rosie was very approachable. If you needed a letter doing, you know, for something, she'd bring you into the office and sit down and do it for you straight away. And I've got a lot of time for Rosie. You know, she's been very helpful in my life.
Una now works for the family services at DHI, and as we'll discover, that is a very key aspect of the culture and services of the charity. But in those last words about Rosie, it feels like her reflections are as much caught up with working with Rosie on a professional footing now as clearly the influence she had on Una's recovery way back when. But also, it proves something that I've often found when working with charities, that the person who starts it, who identifies the opportunity and grows it to a much larger organization, well, their personality, their personal attributes and what they can offer an individual informs the wider culture of the organization. And I love that idea that the culture of a charity is informed by the personal approach and heart of the person who started it all in the first place. In fact, when you look at the origin of DHI, you'll find that Rosie Phillips's background was in housing. And in launching DHI, the link between housing and recovery was at the center of the vision and mission right at the start, as Rosie now explains.
So originally, DHI came out of a housing association, which was Bath Self-Help Housing Association, who had noticed that of those people that they were evicting that were failing their tenancies, a lot of them had problems with drugs or alcohol. And they opened a project, which was a house, a single house called Stall Street. And the project was called the Drugs and Homeless Initiative. And its aim was to sort of bridge the gap between the world of housing and the world of drug treatment. Because at that time, the two were very disconnected. You know, you could be a homeless person, be assessed by a social worker, sent to an expensive rehab and come out and be homeless again. Or you could be on a script and turn up at a hostel as a homeless person and be turned down because you were obviously, well, you were actually being treated for substance misuse, but by being on a script, you were kind of declaring your use. So it was to make sure that those two things were dealt with together. I got that job having worked in London in the field of homelessness, and I like the fact that it viewed these things together as opposed to in silos, which unfortunately is the way lots of problems are looked at. And I also had free rein to develop things, so that's kind of how things got started. And the vision very much was about putting the client at the centre of their support package and making sure that we were able to address their needs, looking mostly at people who are vulnerable or disadvantaged as a result of homelessness or substance misuse. And there's a kind of clustering of social problems that serious social harms that often are linked, such as homelessness, substance misuse, mental ill health, violence. And underpinning those is very often poverty. And that's really, I think, how DHI began as a charity addressing social exclusion and disadvantage.
We're establishing how important it is to achieve accommodation stability in the journey of recovery. To find out more about the services DHI provide, I spoke to Kieran Mullins, who is the Supported Housing Services Manager, and I asked him what it is DHI are able to offer.
We provide absence-based dry houses for people in their recovery journey. So it provides a place where they can live, where they can work to strengthen and maintain their recovery from drugs or alcohol, and take that next step towards independent living.
Safe accommodation in a non-prejudicial and supporting environment was the pivotal development in achieving independent living for Marilyn, as she now explains.
I've been asking for help and going for counselling, and I knew I was in trouble with drinking, and I'd been to the doctors, I'd been to groups, I'd been to psychiatrists, I'd been psychotherapy groups, and none of it worked, and I just was getting worse and worse. Lost my marriage, lost driving licence, lost respect for my children, my jobs were on the line. I didn't stop working, I carried on working. Fell in the River Stour in Canterbury, nearly drowned, but nothing seemed to stop me, and ended up in trouble with the police, and was luckily offered a place in a treatment centre, which I took, and I haven't had a drink since. So my life was turned around, and then when I came to Bath, to DHI Dry House, that kept me safe 15 months.
Marilyn there, who still lives in Bath and is now enjoying a great quality of life. For her, it was the safety of the environment that was the crucial thing. But for so many stories, it is the complete absence of available accommodation that propels people to the crisis point. It is a matter of deeply entrenched folklore that an Englishman's home is his castle. And leaving aside the elegantly antiquated phrasing of that sentiment, it is central to what makes a civilization that people have the right to a roof over their heads. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way.
Most people will resonate with the reality that having a stable home, somewhere where you feel safe, where you can thrive, is something that everybody wants. I think when you then add to the mix more complex issues around recovery, what DHI supported housing has provided is that safe environment that means that somebody in recovery is living with people who are on a similar journey, who can, you know, empathise, they can share their lived experience. But then there's also that professional element to it, you know, having support workers on site who understand that journey as well, but also equipped with the, if you like, the professional skills, the information, the advice, guidance and support that can then help that. This is about helping people to help themselves and make that important next step.
So clearly, the starting point to helping people to help themselves is to have them in a safe place that's warm and dry. Dry, of course, in every sense. But it is an underwriting theme of many of my conversations for those involved in DHI, that people are empowered to drive their own journey of progression through what DHI facilitate. This is very much the case with the DHI Hub in Midsummer Norton. Emma Daly explains why people get involved.
We have got clients who've recognised it in themselves, who have maybe hit their rock bottom if they've, you know, lost their job and they're losing their families, maybe their home, and that's become a problem. But there are other factors that, you know, contribute. If you've got sort of parents who have got involved with social services, who are at risk of losing their children, that could be a reason as to why they're sent to speak to us at the Hub. There are lots of different reasons to why people come forward, and actually part of our work is trying to empower our clients to accept the fact that there is an issue there, and trying to, you know, help them to develop themselves and develop their own skills and coping mechanisms, and to see a way forward, to see that there is a life beyond what their issues are.
The recovery journey is never going to be a straight line of progression. So what Emma was saying in there about helping people develop their own coping mechanisms is absolutely crucial to DHI's approach. Kieran Mullins again.
We see people come through our doors, move into the houses. Their stay with us may be the only time that we see them. They move on and they've done everything they need to do and are able to leave, you know, an independent life. For some, this isn't the time that they've got it right, and we may see them again. I think the critical thing for me is that we are non-judgmental. We're absolutely about, you know, providing an environment and a way for people to make a change in their lives and move on. And I think there's no better, if you like, reward for that is being able to see somebody move on in a positive way, knowing that they are in a really good place to make a success of things going forward. I think, you know, that's what gets you up every day, I think, and into work.
A quick comment on that last thought of Kieran's, because I've noticed it in so many of these conversations, that people involved with DHI are motivated, very simply, by the desire to help people, and at the same time, to help society combat some of its most significant challenges. Challenges around isolation, around losing your connections, homelessness, mental ill health, and so forth. Now, I'm keen to get to some of the other areas that DHI do offer support. But before I leave the specific area of housing, it's worth pointing out that the lack of housing or being on the streets and homeless is not the only challenge DHI have to contend with. And Rosie has a story here of identifying the cause of somebody's isolation and how that informed the direction of their intervention.
A social prescribing client who was referred, he was referred because he had few connections. He was very isolated. He was losing his sight and was nearly blind. And that was why the GP had referred, you know, can they find activities, things he can involve him. Through talking with him, the social prescribing worker actually referred him again to housing because he was living very close to a main road. And she discovered that actually he was very unconfident, even though she found places for him to go. He lacked confidence in crossing this main road. By moving where he lived to somewhere much quieter, not near a main road, he started to go out more and, you know, with support, he found other activities. And the depression that had been kind of causing him to go to the doctors and get medication was greatly improved.
Getting people living in a safe space is a really important milestone. There's no question about that. For it's from that base point that everything else can grow and a positive progression can be achieved. But that is the point where people can go, yikes, what happens now? You're still not engaging with the world in a way that you need to be doing as part of your recovery. Jeff Mitchell works in housing crisis and support.
I think signposting is a critical element of the work that DHI does and that the REACH team does, because we can't do everything for people, and sometimes it's not a very good long-term strategy to do things for people. So part of the reason for the toolkit and the checklist is that it offers them simple steps that they can take for themselves that will help them stay out of crisis in future. And I think that signposting to other services, whether it's sort of money skills training or whether it's legal help or whether it's health services, they're all things that at the end of the day, it's a journey that people need to go on themselves when they're ready with guidance, but actually it can't all be done for people or they'll just be back.
And we'll find out a bit more about that toolkit in a moment. But I wanted to interrupt the thread at this point because I think it's a really good idea to remind ourselves that one of the manifestations of social exclusion is how baffling things can appear to be for those not in the system. It could be technical bafflement or just not understanding the jargon or how best to help yourself. DHI and the REACH service that Jeff was talking about can really help with this. But while evoking the spirit of that awesome film, I, Daniel Blake, here's Jeff with an illustration of how frustrating things can be.
It seems like the people who designed Universal Credit had never met a benefit claimant. To assume that everyone is online and capable to manage a claim and start a claim online and use the internet without worrying is a false assumption. To think that they all have a bank account into which electronic payments can be made, or that they have ID readily to hand and that they're able to upload that onto the claim form. They're all false assumptions that have complete mismatch between the lives of claimants and this new welfare system. Now, in principle, Universal Credit should make it easier for people to progress, move into work at their own pace, with encouragement, hopefully, rather than sort of kind of threats and coercion, but with encouragement to move on to better paid work over time, and that should all be good. But the way it's been implemented and those assumptions about how people can engage with this system are all wrong, and it's the implementation that is failing.
Now, pretty well everybody's going to have some experience of how frustrating it is to get into a system and understand how it works in your favour. That position is going to be considerably magnified with all the vulnerabilities around recovery. Time then to step in with the toolkit.
Yeah, so we're launching this toolkit, which we've called the Futureproof Finances Test. It's a financial resilience checklist. It's all about future-proofing and making sure that people's finances are in check and they have all the bits and pieces in place so that they can move on to universal credit, but also be resilient in lots of other ways. You know, do they have an email account? Do they check their emails daily? Do they open their post daily? Do they use a bank account? Do they have a savings account? All those kinds of questions, which are simple questions that we could ask of anyone, wherever they are, whatever service they're in. It could be a health service or an employment service or a housing service. We can ask those questions whether or not they're thinking about moving on to universal credit and actually start to say, well, actually, these things will help you be better prepared for whatever the future throws at you, so that any money shocks that come along, you'll be better prepared if your ID is in place and you know where it is and you can lay your hands on it immediately, or you have a bank account and those kinds of questions. So it's a 25-question checklist, and it just is yes and no questions. And if the person we're talking to answers no, then that will trigger a mini challenge to help them actually turn that no answer into a yes. And there's some advice that goes with that, just to explain the rationale for why these things are the recommendations that we make to them.
Jeff Mitchell there, describing some of the support services that DHI will signpost their clients to. But in this overview of the support services of DHI, and of course those services they can signpost to, it would be remiss of me if I didn't broaden the reach of those support services to the people who are affected by addictions, although not necessarily on that journey of recovery themselves. Now, you remember Una from earlier on in the programme, whose journey of recovery has led to a place where she's dedicating her life to helping others through DHI. Well, she works for Family Services in Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloucestershire. Support systems of loved ones and those affected by addiction because they're living with somebody with dependency issues is another important area of the work of DHI. Una tells us more.
Often it might be the family member that comes in first, or they come in with somebody and they'll be sitting outside while the person is doing a triage or an assessment, and you can see them. You can tell straight away they're beaten by it. You know, the body language is, you know, self-evident to me. And they will come in and they will start to get support for them. This is the really important thing. There's a lot of support out there for, you know, the people with addiction. But I believe that family members become just as ill, if not iller, than the person with the addiction problem becomes a family illness.
Like so many of these areas that DHI can positively intervene, where there are the kinds of issues that we've been talking about, it is often the open door, the welcome approach that can help people overcome the stigma of association with people with addictions. And as Una started to illustrate there, often people will carry the most incredible burdens rather than go and see someone else to get support and help. I have to say, having met Una on a few occasions, I find her personal approach to be absolutely incredible. She has a wonderful and gentle charisma about her that I can imagine would draw people into a world where they feel comfortable and can get the help that they need. But say a family member or a loved one does approach DHI, what might be the outcome of that conversation?
I've had many families who come into me and they start seeing me, and then I promote the other services that are happening in DHI. And in particular, we have a Burlington Street where if it was a drug addict, they can get down on their medication and then get taken into Burlington Street where we have two detox beds. And then there's another 10 beds in the house, and then they can stay there for 3 months. During that time, they access groups, one-to-one, counselling, housing, you know, all the other areas that most people with, some, not everybody, have with addiction problems. And we can get the family member out of the house, the family home, and into somewhere safe, and then get them, hopefully, a place of their own. And that's happened time and time again. And the whole family heals is the best part of the job.
That image of when the family heals is such a beautiful one and a wonderful note to begin to bring this podcast to a finish. But when I was talking to Una about these services, she lost no opportunity to make an appeal. For anyone listening to this podcast, if you are living with a loved one or you know somebody who's in serious need of the sort of help that DHI can give, then do get in touch.
Do it now. Don't wait till, you know, you're jumping off a cliff almost with the stress and strains of it. Living with addiction is akin to living with a mental health problem in a family.
DHI are absolutely there for people in crisis, and they deal with some very acute issues. But just as is the case in the wider NHS, as early interventions as is possible is always going to be the preference. Jodie Clark is the Associate Director Clinical Lead for DHI.
The earlier we can intervene in someone's situation, we can prevent things escalating to a crisis-led model. It's a spectrum of interventions, and the idea is the earlier we can engage with someone, the more likely for success that it is. And that's across a range of domains of health and social functioning, but if we leave it to the point where crisis is already occurring, in some ways as an organisation, we're in a much harder place to work with people. The earlier we can get involved, the more support we can put in place, the better for everybody. And it's a better use of resources, it's a better use of the organisation's capabilities, but it's also better for the clients, end of the day, and we're here to support clients.
And that takes us neatly back to what Rosie was saying right at the start of this programme. It is the culture of DHI that puts the client and their needs at the centre of their support package. What I wanted to know from Jodie was his reflections on the culture of DHI.
Social justice, isn't it? It's making sure that there are people in society who get the best chances they can to live their life how they want to live it, in an independent way. And that's the values of DHI. This isn't an organisation that wants to save people. This isn't an organisation that wants to create a population that's dependent on the services that they provide. This is an organisation that wants to get people in the door, support them to do the work that they need and want to do, and help them live independent lives. It's about creating a culture of independence through creating social connections, through creating resilience, through creating opportunities for individuals to not need services.
Nicely articulated, but to my mind, the best way of closing this edition of the podcast is to hear the evidence of a lived experience. Someone who can testify in a very personal way that what DHI aspire to achieve is very real and life-changing. Nikki is an ex-client, and he takes up his story.
I ended up street homeless, daily crack, heroin, and special brew was my typical choice. So, yeah, you know, just a lost cause, really. Lost all my family, all my friends, you know, 7.5 stone, in and out of hospital. The last stint I had in hospital, I nearly lost my leg because I was intravenous shooting up in my groin and stuff like that. And then when I got out of hospital, there was a drug worker who said, "Have you ever considered going into treatment?" And I just wanted to get off the streets. By then, I'd had enough of using drugs. I finally realised that drugs weren't the answer. So anyway, I ended up in a treatment centre and started getting my head around just what living clean is about. Got my first 6 months clean in a treatment centre. And then while I was there, they had some referral forms, basically, for the dry house in DHI. And I had a mate in a dry house here as well. So I'd come and see him now and again. And so I'd filled out the forms. And then about a month later, I got a phone call saying, you know, would you like to come in and do the assessment? Came in, got assessed by a member of staff at DHI, and they said, when can you move in? So I said, I can be in 2 days. And that was it, I was in. And it was kind of spring, and everything was kind of hopeful, you know what I mean? Like, back in the real world, clean. My first experience of being clean since I was 14 years old, with a lot of kind of trepidation of, like, God, what's it all about? Not knowing how to do life without being a criminal, without, you know what I mean? I didn't know what living life was. So I moved into the dry house. For me, I'll be eternally grateful for DHI, not just for providing the dry house, but for the support while we was in there. Because we did the groups, we did 12 weeks of groups. You know, you got to meet people, you got to have a daily structure, routine, you know, which I'd never known anything. I'd never had a routine. You know, I stopped going to school when I was like 14. And I found out that these things were really good for me, and I needed them in the end. You know, and I'll just say this, my support worker while I was in the dry house, she was absolutely brilliant. I'm grateful to this day for her, because she used to not only support me, she would challenge me on any of my old behaviours or old way of thinking or old way of doing things. If she saw me slipping back into any of that kind of stuff, she'd challenge me on it, she'd pick me up on it, and we'd talk about it, and just, you know, I could just be honest with her and she could be honest with me, and we could just talk about life, really. When I was living in a dry house, that's when I was full of hope and thinking, actually, I can do this. You know, I can actually look forward to life. Life being clean ain't going to be boring. It ain't going to be all of that. It's actually going to be amazing, you know, having a life. Because when you're in addiction, it's the opposite that's true. It's like being in a prison. You've got no free choice. You haven't got, you know, no free will or nothing. You're just tied to the drug. You have to have drugs. And when I came to Bath in the dry house, that's when I started thinking, right, what do I want to do? And I've always, I left school really early, but I've always had my head in a book. So I just thought, right, I want to go to college. And I started that process. And learning for me is a buzz. And then from college, I went to university. You know, all of that, and from university, you know, I work and all that now. But those early years was when it was all full of hope. I never imagined that life clean could be as good as it is, but it really is. And don't get me wrong, life is what you make it, and there are hard times as well, there's ups and downs, but I don't have to kind of medicate my feelings now. I can deal with the ups and downs of life without having to use drugs, and the good times far outweigh any of the bad times. And for me, it all started with coming to Bath and DHI, really. DHI gave me that opportunity.
Developing health and independence.
Thank you for listening to the DHI podcast. Do let us know what you think and get in touch with your ideas and feedback. And of course, if you want to know any more about anything we've been discussing, you can find us on social media. Search Developing Health and Independence on Facebook, or for Twitter, it's @DHI_online. Or email info@DHI-online.org.uk. And of course, you are encouraged to subscribe to this podcast on your favourite podcast app. I'm Dom Chambers for the DHI podcast, and there'll be more from us very soon.